Welcome to the Daily Wrap-Up, a concise show dedicated to bringing you the most relevant independent news as we see it from the last 24 hours. April 13th, 2021. Thank you for joining me today. I've got a very special guest today that I'm very excited to talk to, somebody that I've been following for quite a long time, and this is somebody who was recently censored for doing objective scientific research around what is happening today. I'm honored to introduce Denis Rancourt. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hey, I'm happy to be here, Ryan. Really glad to be on your show. I love your show, and I'm squeezing it in. I'm super busy with litigation right now, but I'm really happy to be here. Thanks.
Thank you. It means a lot, and I can imagine. So thank you just for being here. I'm sure you have so much going on, but let's start off with the censorship in particular, because this is something that really, this is what made me reach out and say, oh, we got to get him on and talk about this. So as I understand it, recently you were censored from ResearchGate for publishing scientific research. Now, this is something that is not probably shocking to a lot of people in the audience, to people that are following our work, but it is still, for me, it's sort of like the equivalent of seeing somebody like James Corbett censored on YouTube for medical misinformation. It's his sphere, right? This is your sphere, and you are producing sound scientific research, citing, you know, just everything that you would think was supposed to happen before the whole COVID thing. So can you dive into this and let us know what happened? First, I guess, start with what the research was and you know, back up why you think it's sound, and then tell us what happened, and we're going from there.
Well, you know, I think my biggest crime as a scientist in terms of these social media companies that want to censor me and so on, my biggest crime is to write in a clear and direct way. I make it understandable. I put it up front what my main conclusions are and so on. That's my crime. That crime incurs another crime which they complain about and that ResearchGate has complained about, which is this. As a result, it gets read a lot. So my articles on ResearchGate have had as much as 400,000 reads of just one article, the first article on masks, for example. And they said at that time, listen, we're taking this down because it's simply being read too much by people all over the internet. So we can't have that because it's critical of the position of the World Health Organization. So that's my main crime, is being clear and unambiguous, because scientists are trained and indoctrinated largely to write using jargon and to be politically correct and to be very soft in the way that they announce their conclusions, even when those conclusions are very important and very relevant to society. That's my main crime. Regarding COVID, I work in two areas. One is an analysis of all-cause mortality, in other words, the cause of the deaths and so on. So I've written some rather big papers on that, and that's what I would consider the original hard science that I do myself with my collaborators. And then on the other side, regarding the masks, what I did was I wrote review articles that review the scientific literature about masks. So the first one was had in the title the words masks don't work, which is, you know, very direct. But that's exactly what the science tells us. You have to do in a case like this where the effect of the mask is small compared to the person-to-person susceptibility of being infected. The only way to really see if the mask has any effect at all is to do a randomized control trial.
Exactly.
And so I explain this and I review all these randomized controlled trials, which you've also talked about in your work and presenting that, right? And I basically said, look, there have been many of these. They're high quality. They're done correctly. There's a verified outcome, meaning you infect whether the person is really, you analyze in a laboratory whether the person is really infected or not. You don't rely on just their anecdotal evidence that they had symptoms last week and things like that. So when it's done correctly, randomized controlled trials, there have been 14 high quality, 14 or 15 high quality randomized controlled trials up to now. They all say the same thing. We cannot detect a statistically significant benefit from wearing masks, period, irrespective of the context that they did it in and so on. So I reported that, and I cited from several of those studies where they simply say, you know, we can't see a difference. We don't, it's not statistically meaningful and so on and so on. Well, that really upset a lot of people. And One of the reasons for the upset is that people buy into this. They personally buy into wearing a mask. They accept to restrict their own breathing. So it's hard to go back on that. Once you've believed the lie, it's hard to pull back from it. And that's true of scientists as well. Once a scientist has promoted the idea that it's a good idea and that it reduces transmission, which is completely false, then it's hard for that scientist to accept another scientist being highly critical and very clearly critical of that very notion that they even work, right? Mm-hmm. So that was the first article that got me, that article removed from ResearchGate after 400,000 reads. Then I wrote a second article in which...
If I can interject real quick before you talk about the second article. So the viewers, the listeners are thinking about this. So what you just described is the fact that you are citing random controlled trials, by the way, that the CDC had previously cited before all this started, or actually technically right in the middle of when this was happening. And you cite that material, you back it up with facts and sourced material, and you show the fact that this is their findings. And this is what I keep saying, not statistically significant. And then they censor you for what exactly? What was their argument for why?
The argument was that this would lead, you know, the general public to possibly consider that the recommendations of the World Health Organization were not valid, were not good, and we can't have that. And it wouldn't matter if no one would be reading your articles, but actually there's a lot of people reading your articles, and therefore we took it down. And that letter that they wrote to me, I put it up on the internet. Everyone can read it. You know, that's clearly what they said. Mm-hmm. So that was the reason for the first one.
Right. So what they're saying is, despite what they keep screaming about trust the science, they're saying don't trust the science, trust what the authorities are telling you. That's the clear message, in my opinion.
Yeah. And if someone has a message that is having some influence in society, that is being read, that is being going out there, and that is somewhat critical of what the establishment is saying, it's a dangerous message and we need to take it down. And it's automatically dangerous in their eyes because this is related to health, public health, right? So that's the pretext that they use, is the harm that could come from it.
Yeah.
That's right.
One point I want to interject before you talk about the second article that interesting is that exactly what you described is literally what Patreon admitted to in their censorship letter emails to people like Whitney and myself, is they stated you can talk about these things, but you can't, what they said is you can talk about them, but you can't spread misinformation. So what's the difference? When does talking about something become misinformation? When you source what you're saying. And that's exactly what you're talking about. Your articles are, you're not being wishy-washy. You're being direct. You're citing the material and you're pointing to the facts. And that's when it becomes uncomfortable. So I just want people to realize that when you're doing real scientific research and you're citing what you're saying, that's when it becomes a problem. And this is a very important thing, that it's not about trusting anything other than what they tell you should be listening to, the narrative, right? And it's just very apparent to me.
Yeah, even someone who's just giving their opinion and not sorting it, I mean, that's freedom of expression. If that person's opinion was having a big influence, they would censor that as well.
Great point. You know? And this is what I'm saying, is it about, are we not allowed to be wrong? You know what I mean? Like the main thing is
we're not allowed to have influence. And the key reason for freedom of expression, the human reason for expression is that you... it's a way to try to influence your environment, your community, and society. That's the whole idea of expression. And so when they say you can say it, we're not going to put you in jail because you said it, but you have to say it in a closed room where no one can hear it. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's basically what they're saying. So really, they're being two-faced. It's not true that they're allowing any freedom of expression, because the whole notion of the vehicle of freedom of expression is that it's a political tool to have influence in society. That's what freedom of expression in a so-called democracy is all about. It's about that influence. Mm-hmm. And to take that away and to pretend that it's not an ingredient of freedom of expression is just nonsensical. It's absurd. And that's what they're doing.
As you know, so many things are in this COVID era.
Yeah, but that's been absurd, and it's been that way for a long time as well. That's not a new trick. You know, it's an old trick that they're applying heavily this time around.
Fair point. And this is something I keep pointing out in regard to, you know, I make the reference of the PIC numbers, the pneumonia, influenza, and COVID that they combine. As you know, they did this with flu before this, with pneumonia, right? So you're right. This is a classic manipulation, but it seems to be the first time it's been done on such a worldwide scale. Would you agree with that?
Right. Well, you know, it's natural to group together influenza and bacterial pneumonia because the two diseases really cannot be separated. The viral infection and the bacterial infections have co-evolved together. It's a complex disease. You're never infected by just one virus, or almost never. There's always a whole spectrum of viruses that are acting in the winter season, when they can be transmitted, when the transmissivity is high. And at the same time, that's when the bacteria take advantage of that weakened lung tissue and so on. And you know, there's a whole ecology within the lung there that's happening. So you can't, it's almost impossible to technically say the cause of death is this particular strain of this virus, you know? Mm-hmm. So you can understand why scientists would group things at certain occasions when they're looking at causes of deaths and so on, when they can't be separated and it's reasonable to group them. So I go along with that and so on.
Well, if I can ask you that in particular, because that's actually really interesting to me, because I've made it clear to people that it's not all one or the other. I mean, there is such a thing as secondary pneumonia that can be caused by having something else, which is what you're describing. So yeah. I simply point out that it can be manipulated. It could be leaned into one way or the other. And that's what I see.
When you combine them, it's not possible to manipulate it. You have to admit that it's all of these things that were acting at the same time in even a given individual, a given patient that was sick, cannot be separated. Then you're being honest. But if you say, if you take that complex disease situation and say, that's COVID, that's this coronavirus. There you go. And you count it solely as that, and that's the cause of death, that particular strain of that particular virus and nothing else, that's when you're being dishonest, is when you start to separate it and assign it in that way.
Which is what we're seeing today. And would you comment for me on your thoughts on, for instance, why flu is non-existent this year? Like, do you feel that?
that's obscene, right? Of course it's existent. I mean, we did not... The flu has transmitted and has been with us and has infected populations every single winter for the last many, you know, million years, ever since there have been almost, breathing humans on the planet. So it's insane to imagine that particular pathogen has simply disappeared. That's just nonsense. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's all about their false, their fake bookkeeping and their fake way of assigning what the pathogen is that is causing death. That's just crazy.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. I just think it's important to see that, you know, it seems to be being played in a very clear direction. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you can continue on the other article then for us, and which.
Yeah. Well, the second article was one where even in the title, I was very direct. I forget exactly what the title was, but the title, I did the scientific review of some main issues. And so the title went something like masks don't work. Measures don't prevent transmissivity. Vaccines are inherently dangerous. And hand washing and sanitizing surfaces has no effect whatsoever. You know, that was kind of the title I had. And in each of those categories, I reviewed the best scientific published literature that established firmly all of these things. For example, it is firmly established that transmission does not occur by contact. It's not about hands. It's not about surfaces. It's not about any of that. That is firmly established. Only a scientist who is not one and who is being disingenuous would say that that is a significant transmission route, given the science. Okay, so I review that, and I review top scientists saying exactly what I just said. Okay, when I say vaccines are inherently dangerous. Why? It's almost as though I had uttered criminal words when I say that. You know, they, everybody, including scientists, they just freak out. How is that not true? That's exactly why we have trials to test their safety, among other things. That's why, you know, there've been millions and millions of dollars laid out in repair because people are damaged by these products. And there's a whole legal administrative setup to handle that and to contain it, you know. And also, so what I did is I reviewed the science of many known mechanisms whereby when you inject someone with one of these vaccine products, you can have adverse reactions, all, you know, and the kinds of adverse reactions. And there's many kind of review articles that look at the various biological and microbiological and molecular mechanisms whereby that can happen. And of course, people are very different from person to person. Immune systems are very different. So the reactions can be dramatically different from one individual to the next. But in many cases, scientists have, you know, somewhat of an idea of what the mechanism was, how that allergic reaction came about, why the person died so quickly, all these kinds of things. So I reviewed that and I said, look, this is just what we know. Here's 15 mechanistic ways that a vaccine can seriously harm you. How can you say, given what we know, therefore, how can you say that vaccines are not something to be concerned about their safety and are not inherently dangerous?
Yeah.
And so that's what I was doing there in that article.
I've for a long time tried to, as always with my show, trying to keep a very balanced perspective and weighing both sides, even things that I strongly disagree with, I try to consider it. And in this case, for a long time, I've been of the mind that, you know, vaccines in general seem to be very profit minded in the direction of the whole industry. And at the end of the day, I just don't trust the intent behind these people, especially after the Act of 1986 and, you know, indemnity we're talking about even today. And so, but now today, I find it next to impossible to look at what's happening and not see a very clear agenda in here that seems to supersede profit. And this is what makes me very uncomfortable, because this isn't some conspiracy theory. There's real world data to back this up, not even diminished what people call conspiracy theory, because there's plenty of valid things out there. But in this regard, for instance, maybe you can comment on this specifically. The fact that we have the system, the VAERS system, the vaccine adverse adverse reporting system, or I'm probably missing a letter in there, but the point is that this is a system that's been set up. It's the primary reporting system, an official system, and they were discounting it like it's some kind of fringe list that no one should pay attention to. It's right there. How do you not stand back and go, there's something happening here? Because that is very real, and 1% of the reported information and so on, right? So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, you make a very important point when you say it's not even about making money. It's not even about profit anymore. Profit is just a side thing, okay? I think that's really important for people to realize. It's clear when you look at this global phenomenon right now, the way the Western world powers are behaving, this is not about just pharma making profit, which is one way that they do things. And they use money to bribe people and to bribe the system and to transform it and so on. But it's not primarily about that right now. It's way more than that. They have an agenda. By they, I mean, I guess, the USA-based empire. Let's call it what it is. It's an empire. They are in a huge fight right now with an emerging empire, a competing nation, which has sovereignty, which is China, that has ties in Eurasia and including with Russia. And that is geopolitically the biggest, most important thing that's happening right now. And it's military. We're talking military blockades, naval blockades, encircling Russia with NATO. It's hugely military. 1,000 military bases are involved and everything. And it is financial. We're talking about, I mean, they control the global currency. They are not giving access to that currency to these competing blocs. Sanctions, economic sanctions, like we've never seen before. It's an era of sanctions that are extremely harmful. So it's an economic war, and it has a military footprint as well, and it's extremely threatening to Russia and China and any country that wants to have sovereignty, relative to that empire. So that is the context. And in that, they have decided that their attempted takeover of China by financial investment, developing a wealthy class in China that will have ties to the wealthy class in the West, and that will, and you'll be able to take it over that way, which is a common thing that they do, which they try to do in Russia as well, and so on.
We've seen it in South America. We've seen it's a class war in a lot of ways, and we're seeing
of
that.
Of course, it's one of the vectors whereby they keep control over the territories that they possess and control. There's this huge fight going on, and they have decided that they want to intimidate China into accepting trade deals that it will not be able, therefore, to develop, like it's on the development path that it's on now, which is a very successful path because they're very organized and systematic and so on. And so they want to hamper that. So the one attempt is to pressure them into accepting trade deals and conditions and so on that are at its disadvantage. So you intimidate them militarily, you intimidate them by use of your controlled global currency and so on and so on. And failing that, and the other option which they're applying at the same time, I believe, is to completely cut them off economically. So to disallow, to create trade barriers, enormous trade barriers. And I think vaccine borders have a lot to do with that. It's that, and that's why China and Russia immediately developed their own vaccines, right? We've got that going on. So there is an agenda to isolate China economically, which means you stop relying on it for manufacturing, you cut off its ability to get resources and its ability to invest in Africa, Latin America, and wherever it might want to invest to have a beneficial trade and to access resources in exchange for other things and so on. You cut it off from that. And when you do that, when you restructure the world in that way, and when you take your manufacturing investments out of China and bring them into allied Asian countries instead, which they are doing on a huge scale right now as we speak. So when you do that, you there's a high risk, and it involves the global currency. There's a high risk of a huge financial, let's say, reset, or to use that word, unfortunately, but there's a real risk of that. And the people that would suffer most are the working class in the Western countries. I mean, the people within the empire that would suffer most, of course, people in the occupied territories would suffer way more. But that working class still has political clout in the Western world and still has the potential of electing people like Trump. And, you know, there's still possibility of political organizations and leaders emerging and so on. So you need to crush it. You need to crush it. And because they're the ones that are going to suffer, they're the ones that are going to react to this, you see. And so you need to crush it. And the way to crush it is to take away its financial base, which is why you attack small and middle-sized companies, okay? So small enterprises tied closely to independent-minded entrepreneurs and the working class, you kill them. And that's what they're doing. And that's what COVID achieves to a large extent.
Right.
And you kill their ability to organize by killing their means of communications as well. You censor them completely. You take them out of the equation. You already control all the mainstream media, and you make sure that they cannot access other ways of communicating that would be effective. You even take the president of the United States off Twitter and things like that, you know,
right.
Because he represents someone that could... I believe he's authentic in wanting to preserve a working class and to wanting a good, strong, multi-stratified, society in the United States. He believes that a strong empire needs a strong domestic system, whereas these globalists, they don't care. They just want people at the top, the professionals they need, and the high technology, and that's it. And everyone else can just go down into the slumps, you know. They don't care. So that's the overall battle. At the top layer, it's driven by geopolitics, mm-hmm. and because of what they want to do to solve that you see, the geopolitical war is big because if the U.S. loses its hegemony, then all of the elite and financial class and the corporate class that it supports and that are part of that system, they lose power. They lose their privilege. They lose their wealth. They lose a lot of things. As China is able to compete by investing into Africa and Latin America, as they compete with these other investors that are vicious and that are tied to the, and they can compete very effectively because they offer much better deals. That's right. The point.
Right.
The American system has been just treating these continents as just occupied territories, as plantations, basically. And that's the role of these corporations and the financiers is to run and manage those plantations. Okay, that's the other thing is we have to stop thinking that corporations are separate private entities in the West. They're not. They are created. They exist by statute, they are created. They take liability away from the CEOs and the people who invested them. There's a whole legal structure that allows them to exist. They pay taxes, or they could pay taxes more. You change the laws and they have to pay taxes more. They're intimately tied to what I call the empire. And these corporations have a big and important role in managing and running that empire. And that includes the finance sector. So and that includes the big corporations that are about social media as well. Okay, they're intimately tied. The CIA has agents talking to these people and making sure everybody understands in boardrooms and so on constantly. It's a network. It's a network. It's not a private thing.
Well, this we're starting to see. A little before COVID, but after this all started, this aggressive push into public-private partnerships, which is just fascism. I mean, it's just this conflation between the private sector and government, right? And this is, and they play this shell game.
Yeah, it's just
FOIA request. And go ahead.
It's just another layer. It's just another form. But the corporations proper themselves are the system. Mm-hmm. Okay. They are intimately part of what we call the government and the empire, this right. dominance hierarchy that is occupying the planet right now and that is the boss right now. All of these corporations are an intimate part of it. You know, whether they're in Latin America making sure that the peasants don't start growing their own vegetables or somewhere else doing something else and hiring thugs to kill them when they get in the way and all this kind of thing, that's the role that they play. And so it all fits together in that way. And these corporations that run social media, same thing. The government uses this idea, likes us to believe that they're private entities so that they don't have to protect our constitutional rights. They don't have to give us freedom of expression. They don't have to give us any of the constitutional protections. Constitutional protections are central to the system because they are the things that block the system of dominance from over-attacking and over-exploiting the individual and the natural associations within society. Because if they go too far, then there's rebellion and there's all kinds of negative consequences. So there's always kind of this control mechanism, and that's what these so-called rights are. And that's what the Constitution is about in terms of giving it those protections to individuals. So but the government has played this game where they said, oh, but corporations are private entities, so they don't have to do any of that. Well, okay, but they're not private entities, as I just explained, and they are now the main vehicles whereby you can communicate. And we know the central place of communication to keep society healthy and democratic. So therefore, this thing is falling apart mm-hmm. because of this. They went too far when they said, corporations don't have to follow the Constitution. They don't have to respect your individual rights or anything. That was the foot in the door that opened the possibility of what we're seeing now. Okay. Yeah. And that has to be ratcheted back. And we need some. One way would be to have lawyers of the caliber of Ralph Nader, come up somehow and make these really strong fundamental legal arguments that corporations are not these entities that can't be controlled, especially when it comes to fundamental human rights like the right of expression and the right of having influence in the world. We need those fundamental legal arguments. And we need lawmakers to understand that they're destabilizing the whole system. When you make the whole system more and more like a totalitarian system with just a few people on top and everybody else at the bottom and being crushed and not being able to have personal agency and not being able to satisfy their fundamental psychological and biological needs. And psychological is important too, and that's where freedom of expression comes in and so on. Okay, they're willing to crush everybody down to that level. Then you destabilize the whole system because that's when there are these seeds of revolution that come up and where things can spread and where you can, there can be huge distributed displeasure with the whole system. And those systems don't last very long. These extreme slavery systems do not last very long. They're unstable. We know already that a stratified society If you can keep it stable and if you can keep it there, it is much more powerful because it takes advantage of the creativity and the motivation of all the individuals and so on. And that's what made us so successful relative to communism, for example. The communist bloc and so on. That's one of the things that made the system so successful after the Second World War. Mm-hmm. So by going too far, by marching in this way directly into corporate totalitarianism, they're destabilizing the whole system.
Right, but you could argue that that might possibly be the intention. Right.
I don't know that it's the intention to destabilize the system. I think they want to stay on top. They want control and they want to keep it more and more and they want more and more control. And they think they're making themselves safer. Mm-hmm. OK, by having more control and more surveillance and more ability to act militarily against their geopolitical enemies and so on without us saying, wait a minute, we don't really want to risk nuclear war or whatever, you know. They think they're giving themselves more security by this increased control. But from the perspective that I just explained, it's also a way that gives you less security because it increases that driving force towards, you know, revolution and rebellions everywhere and new political movements arising that suddenly become very popular and so on. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, before we move on, I want to touch on vaccines as well, just since we kind of touched on that for a minute. But I like what you mentioned there in regard to Trump and the, regardless of how people perceive the intentions behind the administration and, you know, the political differences, I like how you ultimately described that it's just different forms of empire. Because that's what it feels like, regardless of what they're trying to do and who believes in them, it all ultimately amounts to the same sort of centralized power. And that's, you know, whether you believe or not, it's a dangerous thing.
Oh, totally. I mean, I think the Republican and Democrats for a long time have represented two real distinct groups within the American empire that were competing with each other. They would agree on certain things. And there is an overarching, you know, dominant control on really important things. But there is also this very real animosity and this very real competition. And so on the one side, you have what, if you had to put them in categories, it's the U.S. domestic industry, like the arms industry and the fossil fuel industry on one side, which is tied to the Republicans. And then on the other side, you've got these crazy global financiers. And the CIA is more CIA, whereas the Republican is slightly more tied to military and military intelligence. On the other side, you've got these dirty tricks, CIA, finance scams, mega scams, global scams, all this kind of stuff. So those are the two kind of gangs of elite that have real differences, you know, and that's why politics is so vicious in the U.S. is because they do have real differences. And I think what we're seeing now is we're seeing a real attempt by what I would call the Democratic gang to really crush the other side, you know, make it so that they can never come up again. I mean, take them off of Twitter, take away, you know, because they've now achieved total dominance of the mainstream media, dominance over global finance, at least the private part of global finance. So I think there's some danger coming from that as well. Is it once that internal struggle is gone, then one side can go wild in their totalitarian dreams. Okay, more than if you had this competition. So
go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, just sorry to interject. I thought you were done there. One thing that we can get into then, which is interesting, is that is something that both of these potential empires are agreeing with, which is that we need to force this vaccine on everybody, which seems to be a common thread. Well, I should argue there's plenty of seemingly Republican levels of argument that are saying we shouldn't force vaccine passports. But at the same time, it seems that it's kind of ubiquitous that the vaccine is something we should be endorsing. So you mentioned on the discussion of inherently dangerous. Before we jump over to the mask discussion, as you know, I'm very passionate about, I wanted to get your thoughts on a couple things about the vaccine discussion, because this is one of those points that's just as ridiculous as the rest of this, that has had sound scientific research and evidence from the very beginning of all this, long before even COVID-19, going back to iterations of the same style of vaccine with SARS, and which actually killed children, right? So what are your thoughts on the current vaccines whether mRNA version or the different variations on, I believe, AstraZeneca, those ones as well, and the discussion of maybe antibody dependent enhancement or these blood clots from AstraZeneca. Like, just, you know, where are your thoughts on all this right now?
Right. Well, one thing that's we have to admit, and that's really important, is that there is a new technology. You know, now messenger RNA vaccines have never been implemented before. It's completely new. And so we should try to look at why did they decide to do that? Because there's barely a proof of concept. There's barely, you know, there's no reason that it would work. On the other hand, it doesn't need to work because it's not a virulent pathogen that we're dealing with. It's standard viral respiratory disease and so on, which the immune system handles very well. Thank you very much.
It's just so incredible that you can say that so casually and you're 100% correct. And yet we're in this world where it's,
yeah.
What, just so you guys know, what he said is 100% verifiable. We are dealing with something that is, for the vast majority of the population, not even close to what they're saying it is. But please continue. I just find that to be interesting.
Yeah, no, I mean, just on that point, since you raised it, I mean, they want us to pretend that science didn't exist before 2020. You know, there's a massive amount of science on influenza, for example. And influenza is a whole spectrum. It's a disease with a whole spectrum of manifestations. And it causes very severe epidemics in care homes. It has done all kinds of things that are fully documented in the scientific literature. You can't say that influenza can be explained as one, fatality ratio, infection fatality ratio that's reported in one publication by someone, and that's the number that represents influenza. No, influenza is this hugely complex thing that has, a widespread of possible manifestations in different populations and at different times, depending on the health status of the population and so on. That science is known. And so when you say COVID is new, to be honest, you would have to compare it to that science, and that's never done. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you do that, as soon as you put it in that spectrum of what is known about viral respiratory diseases, there is absolutely nothing special about this thing.
Right.
Sure, there's a lot of medical researcher careers that are, that benefit from publishing a lot of papers because it's a hot topic right now, and that benefit from saying whatever they want, not paying a lot of, pretending like this, wearing these virologist glasses and pretending that the latest mutation of a particular virus can be completely different and cause completely different things, and just run with that and publish, you know, five papers in a few months and all this kind of stuff. I mean, the professionals have behaved really badly, and scientists are careerists as a first approximation, and the virologists are completely off. You know, the particular mutation, the genetic sequence of a particular mutation does not determine everything as they would like you to believe. Okay. Not at all whatsoever.
Well, look at what happened to every one of them that came out and challenged even the most minor part of the narrative. Really early on, we saw them get just completely disparaged, attacked.
Yeah.
I argue there's a level of that too. People that are just afraid, you know, that know they're wrong, but don't want to be attacked, you know, which is cowardly.
Well, you're going to be viciously attacked if you go off narrative, and you're going to be rewarded and significantly rewarded if you support the narrative. So what do you do? I don't, but what do these guys do? That's what they do. Mm-hmm. They do the corrupt science that you see now that has to be retracted, that's published everywhere, that lies by omission, that does all these things. So anyway, that's the situation there. Now, what was your question again?
I
lost track now.
Vaccine, antibody-dependent enhancement.
Right, right.
All that.
Right, right. So it's a new technology. This is really important. Okay, so here's some basic differences between this new technology, which they're bringing in under the cover of COVID. First, you don't need to culture the pathogen in order to make the vaccine. See, the mRNA vaccines are made synthetically. It's a clean, pure process. You never have to culture viruses. You never have to use live cells or live organisms or organs or whatever. You don't have to make the virus in order to use that to make the vaccine. Okay? So there's far less chance of contamination, because the quality control at the production level is really important with these vaccines when you're dealing with all these pathogens that you have to either kill or weaken before you put them into the body and so on. So they get rid of all that. So that means they're cheaper to make. And in principle, they're a lot safer because you remove all of those sources of problems. So, but the other beauty of this new technology is that all you need is for someone to tell you the genetic code of the new, supposedly new virus and the new mutation on paper, whether it's true or not. And you can synthetically make that a piece or whatever of whatever protein you want as part of your messenger RNA. And then that becomes the basis of your vaccine. Okay. So right. You never need to have actually found a pathogen physically, separated it, identified it, purified it, done the sequencing on the material taken only from that pure sample of the pathogen. And from that sequence work from that, you never have to do that. All you need is some guy with a fancy computer and some measurements in the lab that are, not exactly what scientists of the past would have said is acceptable to just tell you, here's the genetic code I have for this thing. And then based on that, you can, in the lab, synthesize what you say is going to be a useful vaccine for this pathogen. That's how you know about it, is through that genetic code on paper. So you see how you can because of this new technology, it's now easier to just make up any pathogen. Okay, anytime you can get virologists to say, "Oh, we found some new symptoms in a hospital, and we took some fluids from the patients, and we concluded that the genetic code is this." And then they pick up this genetic code and they make the synthetic stuff in the lab. And there you go, you've got a vaccine. Fast to make, easy to make. You do away with all the complexities, cheaper to make. And you can inject a billion people and make huge profits. And you can convince the population that their health and even their survival depends on this thing that you're going to inject them with. Okay, you can do all that. You can tie people to the system. They become dependent on the system because they need that vaccine. They're begging for the vaccine. They will line up anywhere. They will go on the internet every day to see if they can get an appointment to get this darn vaccine, and so on and so on. You can achieve all that on the basis of something that is unnecessary and probably does nothing. Well, I would say that's my opinion, okay? Because the weak point in all of this technology is they've got this messenger RNA and it's encapsulated. You need to encapsulate it because your body quickly recognizes free messenger RNA and just, gets rid of it. So you need to protect it. You encapsulate it with stuff that is toxic, is certainly toxic for some people at least. And then you send it into the body, and your story, your cartoon story that you tell everybody, is that this little encapsulated material is going to penetrate into cells in the human body, replicate, and then get spewed out of those cells and go throughout your body in even larger quantity. That is the cartoon that they tell you about. I have read the papers, the last decade of papers on this technology, and in my opinion, it has never been demonstrated. That proof of concept has never been demonstrated. The only times they get replication is if they micro-inject into cells, okay? Actually physically micro-inject. I have not been convinced by the literature that I read that there has been a proof of concept. And certainly not for this new one either. And there have been, So they do things. When you inject an animal or a human with these substances, there's going to be an immune response. That doesn't mean that the cartoon picture of how it works is actually true. There, of course, if you inject something into that the body doesn't want it, there's going to be an immune response, and that immune response will vary from individual to individual and so on and so on. But you see, my problem is I don't even believe that it does what they say it does.
Mm-hmm. I'm with you.
They don't care, and nobody seems to care. And top-level scientists are actually repeating that this is what this technology does. And I would say to them, careful, guys, it's a nice story. Go and look at the fundamental research. Can you prove every step that this has actually been demonstrated?
Right. And this is what I think is really relevant to solidify what you're saying there for people that, want like actual, and I'll include this in the show notes, as I've shown before, for Moderna at the very least, This is their progression. On January 11th, Chinese authorities shared the genetic sequence. Two yeah. days later, they were already making a vaccine and beginning trials.
Yeah.
Right. So this is what Denise talking about here is that remember, even the Chinese CDC had stated that they didn't isolate this and they just basically sent this genetic code. Right. So regardless of that conversation, the idea is you can take just genetic code and then begin to make a vaccine. So I think if the fact that this was prepared and ready to be used to be sent over on January 11th clearly indicates that this was ready and was set in place before all this started. Right. So what are your
It indicates that it doesn't prove it. I mean, I think they can generate these genetic codes fairly quickly. They use probabilistic kind of calculations. They know that it has to resemble other coronaviruses, so they use that as part of the algorithm, and they generate a code based on the impure samples of fluids that they collect from these patients. Okay, so you can do that quickly if you're keen on doing it quickly. You can do it quickly. But yeah, you nailed it there. I mean, here it is. They sent off this genetic code. This is, in their opinion, what the genetic sequence is. It was not peer reviewed. Everyone goes on and on about peer review, but at this stage, it doesn't seem to matter, right? It was not a panel of experts did not examine in detail. How did you do that? Show me your algorithms. Show me your samples. Did you preserve samples that others can verify? Did you this, did you that, and so on? Nobody actually looked at the science of what they were just handing over on a piece of paper. Okay. So that's right. That's correct. And on that basis alone, you can start making vaccines through the technology that I just explained.
And what's weird about the next level is they're already discussing using that same model to say, oh, well, there's a new variant. So we're going to pump the
exactly
make a vaccine without safety trials. That's crazy.
All they need now, at any time they want, they can claim there's a new variant that's virulent, which itself is a nonsense concept because these variants are just mutations and the mutations will always resemble each other. You know, they can't be very different. So at any time they can say new variant, new genetic code, we can make a vaccine. Everyone has to be vaccinated now. It can be like just 4 months after you were just last vaccinated. And if you still want to survive and go to work and everything, revaccinate again, you know, so you're thinking of going out and making a demonstration against the government because you're really tired of your standard of living having dropped dramatically and your purpose in life because you've lost your job, even though you're getting some government money, it's not enough and so on. You're really upset. And they're saying, yeah, but if you want to survive, you got to get another vaccine. So line up. You know, they can that's the kind of control mechanism we have here.
With safety trials is the part that blows me away is that they're openly stating that, well, because this is just a variation on what we already did, we don't need the safety data. And that scares me because this is not, like you're saying, this isn't even sound to begin with. They technically haven't even approved any of these and we're already jumping to the next iteration. That's sure. Alarming to me.
Sure. And over you know, the overriding thing is they want to be able to do this whenever they want, period. It doesn't matter what you say. It doesn't matter what some scientists might say. It doesn't matter what the rules that were in place were before we decided we were going this far. None of that matters. This is what we're doing. And we're going to keep pumping out the propaganda that to survive, you need the government to provide these vaccines and you'll be happy and you'll be able to spend time at home and so on. They'll just keep pumping out that propaganda, and all the nice politicians will wear their masks in the flyers they send to your home to explain that they're doing the best they can for you and everything. And this is the crazy world we're in now. You know, that reminds me of a point I wanted to make on your show is, you know, how can you tell, what's a good gauge that you have advanced along that road towards fascism or totalitarianism? What is one of the best gauges? Because it's hard to tell these things. We're just individuals and we're looking at the world around us and we're trying to figure this out, right? Well, it's not the laws that are passed that are particularly bad or anything. I think one of the most faithful gauges is the individual and the individual's behavior and how the individual sees themselves, okay? So the individual, is the individual, what are their aspirations? What's their self-image? How tolerant are they to being controlled in every aspect of their life, to being surveilled in every aspect of their life? When you accept all that as an individual, and when you accept that you're not going to be able to have political influence, you can't aspire to communicating and starting a new political movement or influencing existing political movements. When you give up on all of that and you become just a person that exists and doesn't have these fundamental drives and desires other than having a career that validates you and being able to have a family, for the professional class, that still exists. But when a lot of people start to lose all of those personal identifiers, that's a clear sign that you're entering into this totalitarian regime. Because a totalitarian regime doesn't happen on its own. It's the public in with the institutions, in with the most influential elite in the society. All that fits together. So you can just look at the individuals around you and how they think, and you can gauge how close you are to that edge of being in a totally totalitarian state.
It's a great point to make, because it's very easy to see that right now more than ever before. And before we jump into the mass discussion, because I think that's an important one for this topic, I don't know if you're familiar, Derek Brose wrote an article covering the parasite stress theory. And this is a discussion that's been had, multiple research articles have been done. So I think it's fair to say that our government at some level is well aware this is something that is probably even considered in what we're dealing with today. But the bottom line is that it shows very clearly in multiple studies that if you have the parasite can either be, that virus is bacteria, something, a fear-mongering concept that gets people scared about being infected or getting sick, that people are very quick to fall in line to an authoritarian government, that they'll tell on their neighbors, that they'll follow directives without pushing back. And the biggest point in the articles, even the research, it says it doesn't even have to be a real threat. It's the perceived threat that creates that kind of authoritarian, mindless following. And it's just an alarming reality that's where we're supposed to be, right?
Well, there are viral respiratory diseases and they're acting and they're important in terms of our health, but there was not a special virus that did this disproportionate effect on us.
Right.
The disproportionate effect from my studies on all-cause mortality were due to the response in the presence of all these pathogens, of the usual spectrum of viral respiratory infections and also bacterial pneumonia, the usual spectrum of things. But you add on to that the social stress of what they did and also the physical confinement of people in care homes, and transfer infected people from hospitals, the sick elderly people from hospitals that are always going to be infected with all kinds of things, put them into the care homes, lock them in, make sure that there's no ventilation, close all the doors and windows. Transmission of the viral parts is through aerosol particles that are in the built environment. Ventilation is the key control factor, and put them in there and make sure that everyone gets infected. That's how you make epidemics in care homes. That's how you fabricate them. And so we see in the all-cause mortality, we see a huge rise in all-cause death, a very sharp peak coming up. And it comes up right synchronously around the world where it occurs. In jurisdictions where it occurs at the same time, which is right after the pandemic was announced by the World Health Organization on March 11th. Just within days of that, you started having this sharp rise, because that's when people really responded. All the MDs, all the treating emergency doctors in hospitals saw themselves facing this horrible pathogen and overtreated people and used what I would call almost experimental treatments, because they're experimental in the sense that they would not normally be that aggressive on regular viral respiratory diseases. But because you had this frenzy in the media and the World Health Organization saying what it said, I believe there's a lot of overtreatment. So you can find, in my research, we have found, for example, in France, hotspots of death that were related to large hospitals, happening at exactly that time and so on. So that's the important thing, one of the ways that we prove that it's the response that killed people rather than a new pathogen itself, a response in the presence of all these pathogens, is that the killing occurred very differently from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. You can have two counties side by side in a state or in a country like France, and one will not see any additional deaths, and the other will have this large spike. Okay. So it's very, very what we call granular. It's very different from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So you can take the United States and you can, that first peak of all-cause mortality that happened in March and April of 2020, it did not occur, virtually didn't occur. It was almost not detected in 30 of the states. Did you know that?
No, that's very...
Yeah. And the reason that the U.S. has such a big peak when you take all the U.S. stats together, I showed a map of this in one of my articles, is the incredible hotspots in New York State
right.
and a few of the neighboring states that were just out of this world. And what you have to understand is that with viral respiratory seasonal epidemics around the world for the last many, many decades, ever since the Second World War, they are never granular to this extent. They're never granular like that. It's the same in every state. It's the same in every European country. It's the same, you know, in Canada as in France and so on. It's always the same. You get this fingerprint of all-cause mortality that is very seasonal. And that pattern is basically the same everywhere. And you can go down to different jurisdictions. You see the same pattern. Right. And I have done that in my research. But then you hit 2020 and that extra huge peak that happens in some places is not present in many, many places, okay? And so we look at scientifically, we look at the standard deviation of that integrated effect of those extra deaths per geographical unit. So it can be per department in France or per region in France or per state in the United States. And what we find is that the standard deviation, the spread of values from geographical spot to geographical spot is dramatically different, is that standard deviation is like much larger than you always get and that we have always gotten, okay? Right. So that is a signature of one of these, it's a signature of the fact that you're not dealing with a standard viral respiratory infection but that you're actually doing something and the something depends on where you are, okay? Mm-hmm. And you see the same thing with heat waves. The only other time where you see these in mid-latitude Western countries, the only other times where you see these sharp peaks in all-cause mortality are in heat waves, extreme heat waves. For example, France had one in 2003 that killed some 10,000 people. It was 10 or 20,000 people. And it was in mid-August, and it was very, very sharp. And that was, but it only happened in France. The neighboring countries didn't get that hot or are used to those climates more and so on. They didn't have it. Okay. It didn't happen in Canada. And so that's an example of one of these things. So when you have external stressors, such as a heat wave or such as a military intervention or such as the kind of lockdowns and the kinds of hospital treatments and the kind of everything they did to our society, those kinds of interventions, which in intensity are very different from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, they can cause visible, measurable, extra all-cause deaths. Exactly. And that's what we see.
Exactly. And as always, it's important to note that correlation is not causation always, right? But it's definitely something to look at. And when you include that one point with all the other things we're talking about and all the other points that are just as valid as that show a chink in the armor, to put it that way.
Well, in our research, we don't do just that. We don't look at just the granularity and the standard deviation. We look at use of different medications, use of different medical interventions. We've got all that data for France, and we can show hotspots and we can associate them to the treatments that were done, for example, and so on.
Right.
So, you don't just have that. In New York, it's clear that the ventilators clearly killed a lot of people.
Well, can I ask you about New York specifically before? So in your opinion, if this was, let's say, not even about COVID-19, some other discussion, it wasn't politicized, and you had something that was being considered an epidemic, and you had a caveat like that, that New York clearly did something different, they made bad choices, that it's nothing like it in any other state. Would you, as an analyst, would you be like, okay, that's something we're going to put off, or would you just divvy it out and give it an average across the rest of the states? My point is that it doesn't make sense to include the New York statistics and then average it out, and that's why it looks like it's larger everywhere else. You would think that a statistician would say, well, wait a minute, the New York numbers don't seem to align. Well,
as far as I know, I'm probably the main person, or for a long time, the only person that kept insisting on how different it was from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, this phenomenon, and that that was a key characteristic, and that we had to look at that. We had to try to understand why. When you have these large differences from place to place, it gives you a handle on a hope of figuring out why it is. You know, so you send in a medical forensic team, and you figure out what the heck happened here, because it's off the charts. So what happened? Let's figure this out. See, the point that I often make also is, it didn't have to be a particular virus. Any array of the usual viral respiratory disease viruses that are always around and that transmit in the winter, if you do these kinds of measures, it would have had the same impact. It doesn't matter what it was, okay? It matters that there are pathogens, of course, but there are always pathogens, and there's always a whole ecology of pathogens. And, you know, but if you combine those pathogens with the measures that were imposed, and the aggression and the assaults that were done on people and on people in care homes, that's when you get these extra deaths. Yep. And in my studies, I don't try to attribute cause of death. I look at all cause mortality. So right. I know they're hard numbers, and I can see those peaks coming up. The U.S. is unique in the world in that in the following summer, they had huge amounts of additional deaths. In the all-cause mortality, the all-cause mortality did not come back down to the trough level, the summer level that you normally have, that it has had for the last many decades, okay? Mm-hmm. It's way above it. So in the U.S., they were killing people in the summer, which is unheard of, okay? Mm-hmm. And that is unique. Didn't happen anywhere else. Mm-hmm. Everywhere else, they came back down to the normal summer levels between this first COVID peak and the next rise due to the increased transmissivity because you were entering into the winter season that we're into now, okay? That's really important. And recently, in fact, yesterday, I was talking with my collaborators, and we drew a map of the magnitude. We quantified the magnitude of these deaths above the summer baseline level that we know has been the same for like the last two decades or more. And we quantified that, and we made a map of it. And you get this red, intense feature all in the southern states. Mm. It's a band across the southern states of the U.S. It doesn't happen anywhere else. Okay, so that's one of the things you have to consider when you're trying to understand what did this? How did they kill people in the summer?
Right. Well, here's an interesting thought on this, and this brings us into the last part of the discussion I want to get in before we run out of time is the masks, because another incidence of this where we can see an obvious correlation that I think is undeniable at this point. There's a couple of caveats, but you can clearly see that by and large, the people that had the highest mask adherence have the most clear spikes in, you know, all the numbers we're talking about. And the places that seem to go away from the mask have a very clear reaction in the positive after that, within weeks. So do you think it might correlate between the southern states, the humidity, the moisture that's being created? I mean, you probably are familiar with the British Medical Journal 2000, I don't want to say the date wrong, but this the only random controlled trial I've seen on cloth masks compared to medical, where they find very clearly that moisture retention makes these things dangerous and increase your risk of infection. So two parts. One, do you think that that's where it might have been the interest in southern? And then let's get into masks and really specifically, like, in your opinion, the dangers both medically and psychologically, physiologically. So what do you go, please.
I'm just going to give you my sense of it, given all my research and thought and so on. I don't think that the masks are what is causing these peaks in all-cause mortality or the anomalies in all-cause mortality. There are a lot of reasons that there would be correlations. There are many reasons, and I could give a long shopping list of them, you know, but that doesn't mean that there's a causal relationship, and I don't believe there is. Mm-hmm. Regarding the masks, I mean, I do believe masks are very harmful, but they're not the cause of actual all-cause mortality. We're talking killing people in a short time that it's measurable in all-cause mortality. I don't think it's the masks contributing in a big way to that.
Let me add one real quick point there so you understand my full thought on why I think that possible is, for instance, going back to the discussion of the 1918, where we know that it's discussed that bacterial pneumonia was by majority of the cases. And obviously the argument is that it ties in as secondary in regard to what they were dealing with. Now, bacterial pneumonia is contagious and the symptoms look very similar to COVID-19. So my thought was possibly that we were seeing something similar, that we know that it can cause an increased risk of infection. So is it possible it's causing this increase of the very thing that caused what we know was the predominant factor of 1918? And maybe that's what's happening now. So that's my thought on it. So what do you think about that? Oh, looks like we might have lost you here, Denny. That's unfortunate. I'll give it a second, guys. That's really unfortunate. I was really hoping to talk about masks with him specifically. Let's see. Well, worst case scenario, we can wrap it up here, guys. I'll give him a second to possibly... Oh, you still there, Denny? If you can hear me, you're just... It's a little bit... it's just froze on you. Maybe you can try to bounce out and come back in, see if that works. I'll give it a second just to see if maybe he can make it back in, or maybe the interconnectivity will refresh. It's funny this happens, by the way, is before we got started, I was a little late getting this interview going for exactly this reason. I had to restart my modem. There's all sort of things happening. I can promise you that the powers that shouldn't be do not want us talking about this stuff. So call me the crazy conspiracy theorist, but it's funny that this continues to happen. In any case, I think it's interesting that, you know, his research on this has been absolutely fantastic and sound sourced. And the information is showing exactly what we're talking about. And here's an interesting thing to even point out is that as we discuss here, maybe he'll jump back in here in a second, is that he, as he just stated, does not feel that is the driving force, where I've become quite convinced that that's a huge factor just because of the very clear data we have. But what the point is that he can argue that that's not the main point. And I can say, I think it is. Yet we can both realize and agree that it is causing problems, you know, and this is what's funny is you can have people on all sides of this conversation that they'll dismiss as the same thing that can have totally varying opinions on very clear information. And the reality is, as he pointed out, and you can read his research, and I'll include this in the show notes, as I've done myself, which is the fact that these things are causing health problems. And the science they tell you to trust has been showing that for a very, very long time. I was going to bring this up before we bounced off. And this is one of the things that I just recently went over and something that Denny had also pointed out. And this was the title is Face Masks in the COVID-19 Era, a Health Hypothesis, which goes over everything we're talking about. Oh, here we go. Looks like we got him back.
Okay. Hey. I don't know what happened. I've never seen that before, but I momentarily lost the connection here for some reason.
No worries. I was just laughing about my problems before we got started, too. It seems like nobody wants us to talk, Denny.
Oh, yeah, it's crazy. That was Mike.
No sweat.
Fire of signal went berserk for a while.
No worries. Well, here, what I was saying is, just to reiterate my thought, was the possibility that we know that in 1918,
yes,
it's been discussed that masks were huge. That bacterial pneumonia was the leading factor there. My opinion is that masks could have been a reason that happened based on the science. But bringing it to today, and we know that bacterial pneumonia is contagious, that it has very similar symptoms of COVID-19. So do you think that that's a factor there and possibly a reason this could be happening just as a possibility?
Yeah, it's a possibility. It's not something that I've studied, and it's a possibility. There are mechanistic roots that, you know, where that makes sense. I also saw recently, I'm starting to become aware of all this work that the 1918 so-called epidemic could have been induced by vaccinations with some pretty nasty vaccines that were being tested and spread in the population at that time in a big way, and that could have directly infected people, and that could explain why all the young men that were injected in this way, because they were military people, would have suffered in this way. And so there's a lot to try to reconstruct historically when we talk about 1918, because that is such a unique event. But it certainly was not the simple case of a viral respiratory disease, like they like to call it, the flu, right? There's no way it was that. As you said, it's now proven that it was the bacterial infections dominated the thing. So masks, yeah, it could play a role. It's nasty. You don't want to, now we've got the sun conspiring against us. So you don't want to. Yeah, it's a possibility, but it's not something that I've researched. And
fair enough.
You know, coming back to the United States, though, I feel that, you see, the thing, you know, I talked earlier about how they like us to forget that there was even science before 2020. Mm-hmm. One of the major discoveries of the last couple of decades in the modern era has been the work of Sheldon Cohen, Professor Sheldon Cohen in the United States. Maybe you've talked about his work on your show before, but he did his whole career showing and demonstrating that there are two factors that affect whether or not you're going to be infected by a viral respiratory disease, and if you are infected, how sick you're going to get. And he showed that the two dominant factors, and he did this in the 70s when you were allowed to infect university students with known strains of influenza and so on. He did all these studies, and he proved without a doubt that the biggest factors are the amount of individual stress that you are experiencing in your life, and also the degree to which you are socially isolated. Those two factors dominated everything else. So determined what. So that is a very important discovery, and it's highly relevant to our discussion, and it's never talked about. Okay, so now imagine an elderly person, because we know from science now, since the early days when Professor Cohen was doing that research, we now know that the effect of stress on an elderly person, the effect on their metabolism, is probably an order of magnitude greater than on a healthy young adult. Okay, so stress is a dominant factor. Now, what causes stress? What attacks your self-image and social isolation? Okay, lock people in. Don't allow them to communicate with others. Don't allow them to have closeness and proximity. Stress them out with that they're going to die. Make them lose their jobs. And you know, when we talk about losing the jobs, it's not just the jobs on record. People who are living day to day, who are, you know, underemployed, have all kinds of little jobs that they do not on the record, let's say, okay? That's very common. They'll do favors for people, and they have contact that way, and they get some revenue from that. And that is extremely common in the poorer working class and so on. So when you have this kind of a so-called epidemic, you take all that away. The restaurants are closed. All the businesses are closed. All the people that would normally employ those people in that way, everything is dead. So people are dramatically affected in their lives. The most vulnerable people are the ones most affected. And stress and social isolation are the dominant factors regarding infection and how sick you're going to get. So put all that together, plus make it the hottest states where the heat is intolerable in the summer. That's an additional physiological stress that you're used to handling, because you're outside, there's a bit of a breeze, you have a routine, you still have social contacts. Now take away all those things and add the heat to those people who are not in air-conditioned places, okay? Imagine the toll on these populations when you do that. Right. Those are some of the mechanisms that I can think about. And we are exploring now, from the data that is accessible for the United States, we're trying to see the kinds of things that might explain that. But I'm going to look at it. I'm going to consider it, but I don't think mask wearing is going to be a big one.
Well, my mindset here, why don't I just read this real quick, because I want people, and I know you're familiar with this, and I find this to be a very important one from Stanford, as you can see right here, that basically challenges everything we're hearing about masks in general. It's January 2021. And the idea, It just read you the conclusion here for those that haven't seen it. And on Twitter right now, you post this completely, you know, valid scientific study, and it won't let you post it. It says no. But here's the conclusion. The existing scientific evidence has challenged the safety and efficacy of wearing face masks as preventative intervention for COVID-19. The data suggests that both medical and non-medical face masks are ineffective, as you're pointing out, to block human-to-human transmission of viral and infectious disease such as SARS-CoV-2 and COVID-19, supporting against the use of the face mask. And it points out, wearing face masks has been demonstrated to have substantial adverse physiological and psychological effects. And it goes on to include hypoxia, hypercapnia, shortness of breath, all these things that people have discounted as absolute conspiracy theory. And this is being not hypothetically, but is absolutely possible with these masks. So considering that, then the physiological, the psychological effect, more importantly, with what the point you just made, do you feel that's,
it could easily be a contributor, but the study to establish, because you see, you're putting me in a difficult spot because you're asking me about actual deaths. Okay. You're not asking me about extreme discomfort, being sick, all these kinds of things, right? You're asking me about actual deaths that I can look at and measure the data. And how would I explain those deaths? Mm-hmm. So that's why that's why I'm commenting in the way that I am, right? Of course, masks can do all these things and are highly destructive of our human fabric because you can't see people's faces. You know, a child learning to speak, an infant first contact with the parents or first contacts with the caregivers in a hospital, whatever. My God, you know, like it's just insane. It's a sick society that a mask society is a sick society, I believe. And so the long-term damages I'm sure are massive. And that's what I reviewed in the article that ultimately got me completely taken off, locked out of my account on ResearchGate.
Right.
Is my review of all of those harms and the known mechanisms of those harms and the people who are starting to report those harms. And I reported those harms up to February. I did the literature review up to February. And since that time, this has now become an increasing research topic because of the prevalence of masks, right? So there have been way more since then. And even some mask types have been banned, for example, in Canada as a result of the toxic substances that have been found that they contain and so on. So this is just continuing, right? This is continuing. But I don't want to push the theory that a mask caused these significant increases in all-cause mortality because I think there's so many factors playing here. I'm not prepared to say that. Okay.
Well, let me be clear. That's not what I was suggesting at that last moment. That's something I think we should absolutely be considering. What I was referencing at the end was more to your point about the psychological effects and that the blocking of the face and the interactions, how that could, I mean, I think it's a no-brainer that those kind of things and isolation and how it leads to an increase in mortality in general, any kind of change like this, but not so much that I'm trying to say put a fine point on it.
Even your cognitive development, especially when you're learning a language, of never hearing or rarely hearing clear voices, rarely hearing the enunciation, the accent, not seeing the lip movement, not seeing the facial expressions completely, all of this is extremely important. There are studies that show that people who rely on that facial signaling in learning language learn language better and are better able to learn new languages and so on. Okay, so there's all kinds of studies that show the importance of these things. And part of me says, you know, you shouldn't need these studies. Just when I see a group of school children the other day walking towards the park and they're all wearing masks and they're accompanied by three so-called educators that are masked and have shields on and are having to scream at the kids because they can't be heard. And these poor children are breathing through these masks. I mean, this is crazy. We're talking outside in the sunshine with wind. People are flying kites and they're forcing these kids to wear masks rather than developing their independent thinking that, you know, it's windy, it's sunny, we're outside, we can take them off now, guys. You know, like, and this is why, and this is how we believe masks work, and taking it as an opportunity to educate. Instead, they're training them to be obedient and training them to do nonsensical things because we say so. And this is what they're doing to school children now. Mm-hmm. So that, to me, I mean, I do look at all the scientific literature, but I wouldn't need to. I mean, that's just obscene. And many parents know this, and many parents are against these darn masks and are reporting on the harms to their children and so on. I talked about the large German study that where academics are receiving all these reports from parents about the effects of masks on their children. It's a massive project, and it's coming out. So, yeah, masks are nasty, and this whole period is nasty. Getting us to behave in nonsensical, non-scientific ways just because they want us to obey and they want to be able to control us more. It's uh-huh. all we're in a really bad place right now.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, to wrap this up, so I know an interesting time. Where do you see this going, and what do you think people should be doing right now? You know, because it's a time where we are so conflicted with different authorities and different you know, they want you to be confused. They want you to just check out and follow the authority. So what if you could give the people out there listening, what should they be doing to fight back? You know, who should they be listening to? You know, what's your advice to people right now?
Well, okay. One thing I could say just off the top is if you're feeling rebellious, or if you're angry about this, or to you it makes no sense, I would like to personally tell you, you're right. You are absolutely right. You have every reason to be angry. You have every reason to feel rebellious, to want to get out of this trap, to want to change society towards something different. You are justified, because this is bad for everybody. And it has gone way too far. It's insane. So that would be kind of my first reaction, is to say, I'm with you. I totally support you in your feelings, and do not lose that, and try to use it as motivation to express yourselves, to have political influence, to talk to the school boards that you're dealing with and all the institutions that you're dealing with, and make it clear to them that you do not agree. You know, if it comes natural to you to oppose in this way, then go ahead, oppose. Don't hold back. Oppose them with good, solid, rational arguments, or whatever arguments you have. Tell them how you feel. Do it. I think that we need a whole bunch of people doing that everywhere that they can.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, now is the time to put your foot down and stand up for what you believe in, because yes. It's the same thing I keep saying lately, as James Corbett put it, is that, you know, just like past examples of authoritarian rises, that we will look back 30 years from now and go, man, I wish I would have acted then when I had a chance to.
Right? There is some encouragement in the United States. There is a strong movement of people who will absolutely not be vaccinated. Mm-hmm. You know, the body is the ultimate thing that I'm going to protect. Okay. I would not allow you to put me in an environment where I'm breathing in toxic substances, and I won't allow you to inject things into my body just because you say they're good for me. That is something I control absolutely, is my body. Okay. So I find it's very encouraging that in the US there is a strong movement to that effect, that, you know, it's my body, my choice. You know, I agree that people have the freedom, if they want to harm themselves, that they can have the, you know, I'm one of these people who, morally speaking, if you want to harm yourself, well, that's part of your freedom as well, and that fits into society. Right. But if you say, no way, you're not injecting this into my body, that's it. That should be the limit. And if they're going to devise ways to get around that your right to say no, like not allow you to travel, not allow you to enter certain places or buy food or whatever, that's obscene, and it needs to be fought strongly. So I think that's where the limit is. That's one limit that they absolutely have to contend with. And they are trying to convince us by the usual propaganda, and trying to make us feel like we're bad people if we don't agree, and all this kind of stuff, right?
Yep, as usual, right? To make you feel less than, so you just acquiesce. Thank you so much for being here, Denny. I really appreciate the conversation. I think we covered a lot of good stuff. I would love to have you back on in the near future. Is there anything else you'd like to say, social media links you want to share, or anything like that?
One last thing, since one of the reasons you invited me was about this ResearchGate thing. Mm-hmm. And I find a lot of people react by saying, oh, but it's a private enterprise, and they have it's in the terms of agreement that they can just cut you off, right? Well, actually, it's not. If you read the terms of agreement, what they did to me is illegal. And they often act illegal when they feel they can get away with it. Mm-hmm. And when in this kind of totalitarian atmosphere where everybody's saying these things and repeating these things, they just do whatever they want. But if you actually look at their terms of agreement, their terms of use and so on, for them to block my entire account that I've had since 2015, they have to have reason. They have to have what they call good cause. Okay. Mm. So that's a legal question. did you have good cause to do this? And the only time that they can take my things away, take away the articles, is in connection with using you shall not, and this is the closest they come to it, when they want to remove or limit a single article, you shall not act unprofessionally or inappropriately, potentially in a way that's potentially harmful or potentially dangerous content that you want to put out there, okay? Well, I think I was acting professionally and appropriately when I reported on the scientific known harms due to masks.
Right.
Period. So legally, they had no, they broke the terms of agreement. I could sue them on that basis. And I'm considering my options, but I may do that. I'm certainly going to explore in which jurisdiction can I sue them, because there's going to be a jurisdictional battle. They're in Germany, and they like to say that you have to go to Germany and fight them in the German courts. But they are acting here in Canada, and they are providing a service in Canada. And I think the Canadian courts should be able to hear these kinds of contractual cases, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is so incredibly profound, because, you know, this is what we were talking about earlier. You know, you are, you're conducting sound, objective scientific research. You're citing the material, and they don't like the finding. That's not how science works, right? I mean, if you could argue,
and it's not consistent with their terms of service either.
Right.
It's not at all. In fact, their terms of service, it is presumed that they're acting in a way consistent with science, that they're acting for the good of people through propagating information and so on. So they're violating their own terms of service.
Yeah. And, you know, I asked the point, this point in a different recent show, you know, when did trust the science become trust the authorities and ignore all the science? Because that's what's happening right now, you know, and it's just very, very apparent that what they're trying to do, and it doesn't have to do with actual sound information, which means, to your point, not only ResearchGate, but the government, the mainstream media, they are taking direct action, willful action that is putting people's lives at risk. That's a big deal. And I think hopefully this will eventually come out a little bit more. But I think the fact that we're seeing people like yourself censored, you know, whether we're talking scientists, doctors, PhDs, that are doing the right, conducting their research in the way that prior to all of this would have been, whether you're finding contentious findings or not, completely acceptable. And now suddenly, all of a sudden, counter findings are dangerous. That is a recipe for an authoritarian medical dictate. And that's what we're seeing happen right in front of us.
Beyond a recipe, it is a medical dictatorship. It's crazy. Right. Yeah. Right. Thank you, Ryan. Thanks for having me on. It was wonderful.
Yeah, my pleasure. And maybe if you end up doing some litigation or just anything else you feel like talking about in the future, you're always welcome on the show, Denny.
Oh, thank you.
Do you want to drop any social media links or anything? I can just include them in the show notes for
you. I'm on Twitter. I'm very active on Twitter these days. And I'm just now, especially I'm motivated by what just happened to me, I'm putting together a new website. So I've got someone helping me, and it's looking better and better, and there'll be a lot of good stuff, and it'll be easy to find. And so that's happening now too, but I don't have it yet.
Great. Well, let me know.
I have lists of links to all my articles on my blog, which is activistteacher.blogspot.com. And if you go down the last few blog articles, you'll find a complete list. And there's a main menu there, a complete list of everything on COVID and so on, and including my interviews and everything. So that presently, that's one of the main places where I list everything. Activistteacher.blogspot.com.
We'll make sure and include that below for everyone to click on. And I highly recommend you check out his work. If you're unfamiliar, some of these research compilations, the one we were just discussing in regard to all this stuff, are very, very well done. So thank you again for being here. And as always, everybody out there, question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.